Everyone get a handout. This is newer than the one you had before. I updated the bottom two parts, two rows from Francis Schaeffer. I inserted Dr. Sproul, who passed away in 2017. I didn't realize it was that long ago. And rearranged a few other things on the right. And we'll finish up our series today. Now, I missed two Sundays. I haven't reviewed Tripp's notes. He went into the history of the OPC. I don't know if he covered the fundamentalist-modernist debate. Oh, he was just focused on the internals of the OPC. Okay. So that's the background of the OPC. If you recall, when I last spoke on this, what, a month ago? We have it here in the middle column by B.B. Warfield, so middle row, middle column, Azusa Street Revival. That's the beginning of what's known as the Modern Charismatic Movement. That was in California. The Scofield Reference Bible, which gives us the dispensationalism that we know of today. And then the Fundamentals, which was a number of volumes, I want to say four or five volumes, written by a number of well-known scholars from Baptists to Anglicans to someone like B.B. Warfield, fighting the liberals of the day. Back then, the political liberals were called what? Does anybody know? Like Wilson, Woodrow Wilson? Progressives. Yeah. Yep. Yes, Dan. I don't remember. So it was not the same as today. It's kind of funny, but there is an overlap. And I'll talk about the overlap when I get to the section on progressive globalism affecting the church today. So they were fighting them because the liberals in the church, at the time they were called liberals, not progressives, in the church. Because they were attacking the miracles of the Bible, they were attacking the supernatural nature of Christianity and the like, because they were scientific materialists, essentially. They may even deny the soul and things like that. And they were playing games with the confession. As you recall, Tripp pointed out the Briggs trial, and then 30 years after the Briggs trial, everything fell apart. This is about that time when things were falling apart. And as you know, it takes time for leadership in large organizations to catch up with what's going on, because decay is quicker than shoring up and growth, because we live in a fallen world. And so in 30 years, it was falling apart in the mainline Presbyterian church. So they wrote those that series and handed out to all the pastors, if I recall correctly. Rich Mann was behind it, and that's what you need. You need men with power and influence who want to support the church. But it didn't hold anything back. By 1923, you had the Auburn Affirmation, which was signed, I have the details elsewhere, signed by something like 2,000 ministers in the Presbyterian Church of America, USA at the time. And it was a liberal proclamation that said, well, you know, we can all be Christians and we can just disagree whether there was a virgin birth. We can disagree whether there are miracles in the Bible. We can disagree whether the Bible is inspired by God and still be part of the church and be Christians. That's basically what it said. Yeah. And it's, you know, written by all these ministers. You're like, dude, start bringing up charges. And this is one of the problems, and I don't know enough about the history of it, but that it seemed that the conservatives had, no one brought up charges. Maybe they tried and they had no leg to stand on, because if you don't have a presbytery backing you up, you can't really get anywhere in Presbyterianism, right? Your presbytery won't back you up to bring charges. So this shows more degradation in the Presbyterian church and in the other churches. The modernist fundamentalist debate was the debate between the fundamentalists, which is what they would have called us. It was a slur, right? The Scopes Monkey Trial, for example, and they're making fun of us because we don't believe in evolution. You believe your uncle's a monkey, but you're going to make fun of us. And things like that, right? So we're called the fundamentalists because of the book, The Fundamentals, for one thing, but it became a slur, right? They're the modernists. They believe in modern science and thinking, and we're going to conquer the world, and progressive that way. Back then, in the political realm, the idea of progressivism is we can move forward and the world's going to get better. And you can see it in the sci-fi literature. I remember reading some of that growing up, and other things like that. So, you know, they thought that World War I was the war to end all wars. Remember that? We're going to have heaven on earth. That's the progressive mindset back then. That's one of the tie-ins to today's progressivism. We're going to have heaven on earth today, but of course they have variations of what heaven on earth looks like. Everyone has a different version than the Bible, apparently, if you're not a Christian. So that's the big debate within the churches. It wasn't the Presbyterian churches only. It was the Methodist churches. It was the Baptist churches. They all had this internal struggle with the liberals, we would call them, or the modernists at the time, and the fundamentalists, or what we would call conservative today, in the churches. And as you know, the history, we lost. We got kicked out of our own denominations. The Methodists got kicked out of their own denominations. The Baptists, of course, were never organized as such, but they had a split, as it were, in their numbers. So that's the background of the birth of the OPC in 1936. J. Gresham Machen was put on trial because he refused to support the foreign missions and the like, and he created a foreign mission board, independent foreign mission board. Instead of taking the tithes money and bringing it to the foreign mission that was promoting modernism and a false gospel, they set up an independent board. Not within Presbyterianism, wasn't voted by a Presbytery, independent board like a Baptist would, and said, we're going to support these guys because they're going to support the gospel. Now, they never said that's the way you should normally do things, but you do that and you have no other option if you want to do your duty as a church and a pastor. And so they did, and they brought him up charges for that. He knew it was a kangaroo court. It was a foregone conclusion. He tried to defend his case, but they shut him down through Robert's rules and procedural machinations and things like that. And that's one reason why we still have an unwritten rule in the General Assembly of the OPC to let people talk instead of shutting them down. Because they shut down Machen. But it wouldn't have mattered anyways. It was a foregone conclusion that they were going to kick him out of the church. And so he and, I want to say, 100 other ministers, it's been a while, left. It wasn't a lot. When you have like something like 2,000 people who signed the Auburn Affirmation and only 100 are like, okay, we're done with this denomination. We've tried what we could and they're kicking us out. That's pretty sad. There wasn't a lot of conservatives left. Part of the reason why was because when you left back then, the church left, the presbytery, the liberal presbytery would say, no, we own that church building because we gave you the funds to support that building. We own that building. If you left back then, you could lose your building. They were heartless. As we know today, liberals are heartless, aren't they? They talk the talk, they don't walk the walk. It's all talk, of course. Smokescreen. And so that's one of the big problems, and you know, the pressure upon the conservatives not to leave and their churches not to leave. You're not going to have a building. Now it's going to be hard to have a church, as we know ourselves, without a standing building. Now, to back up a little bit, when Machen and the others were fighting against the Foreign Mission Board of the Presbyterian Church USA, PCUSA, what they were doing, that board was supporting someone, I want to say her last name was Rice, Tripp, you remember. I was just trying to do a short little background because I thought Tripp would cover some of this. She wrote a book, and the book was trying to explain how if you go to China, you really shouldn't preach the gospel to them because there's different ways, people have different knowledges of who Jesus Christ is. You know, typical liberal stuff, right? There's more than one way to get to heaven, that kind of stuff. And they were supporting this woman. And, you know, Machen, if you can imagine of us today, if the OPC did that, we'd be like, what in the world? What are you doing? Pearl Buck, thank you. I kept wanting to say Anne Rice for some reason. No, Pearl Buck. Because it reminded me of Rice Christianity. One of the things that happened would be they would feed the poor over there. China was very poor. They've only had more prosperity in the last 20 years. They would feed them rice and get lots of converts, but never really preach the gospel and instruct them. So you call it Rice Christianity. And the OPC early on rejected that. We said, we're not going to follow that technique. If you're going to feed anybody, you better preach the gospel to them and nothing but the gospel. So that's one of the things going on there, and that's relevant today. We'll come back to that. And so I put other names on here that are more known in our circles, Cornelius Van Til, the establishment of the Westminster Theological Seminary, which was 1929, which wasn't that far from 36. Because, again, Princeton went downhill. Princeton was lost by then. So they created Westminster Seminary. And the monies behind it was from Machen. Machen came from a rich family. He never married, and he had the funds. So he created Westminster Theological Seminary. One of the buildings, one of the places they were interested in going to is Denver. They checked out, what's the name of that place? Bellevue? The church we had training in. The Pillar of Fire building. Federal and 86 or something. It's like an old, old building from the turn of the century. It's got a tower, and they have a radio program. No, I'm talking about the one up in Westminster. Thornton, yeah. They were interested in that building. That would have been kind of cool. But they ended up in, you know, Pennsylvania. Yeah. Is it New Jersey? Where's Westminster, actually? I don't really know. I should know, you think, but I never went to a normal seminary. I'm weird. That's just an interesting tidbit, right? Pardon? Probably wasn't called. Yeah, that's a newer. Is it? Well, anyways, we all know the building. I don't remember the name of it. If you've seen it there, it kind of stands out on its own on the east side of the highway. Yeah, on the hill. Yep. So, and then Murray is another well-known name in our circles. After 2 years after 1936, when the LPC was established, the Bible Presbyterian Church split from us. They were what we would today call fundamentalists. They said pastors can't have drinks. They shouldn't be able to can't have drinks. They shouldn't have alcohol. They shouldn't drink alcohol. They were also in favor of, they were open to dispensationalism and the like. And we said, no, can't do that. And other problems like that. So they left us, unfortunately. But now they have changed. They've become more reformed in those regards and maybe even more conservative in other ways. I have a friend of mine who comes on the Thursday study, and he's part of that. So he had the Great Depression, of course, to show us the historical circumstances there. E.J. Young, again, he would only, mostly be, he might be known more than Van Til in some ways because he was quieter. Van Til, you know, made a lot of waves, but the stuff E.J. Young wrote is still used. I use it in seminary. You may not get Van Til, depending on what apologetic school you use in your seminary, but you probably likely get E.J. Young. Or even Burkhoff's Systematic Theology, which was taught at Moody Bible Institute, of all places. I remember seeing that one day. I was like, what? Maybe they picked through it. I don't know. It's really weird. E.J. Young wrote a lot of Old Testament stuff. That's why he wrote a survey. He wrote specialty stuff on the Old Testament, and he was a very smart man. And, of course, we also put him on there because he trained Dr. Kappas, and he was Dr. Kappas' Ph.D. advisor, or Th.D. advisor. E.J. Young taught himself Arabic on a two-week boat trip to the Middle East, and he knew it fluently. No, it was Arabic. Portuguese, there would be no purpose for that for an Old Testament professor. No, it was Arabic. That's the story Leonard likes to tell people to show you how on top of things he was. He really liked his languages. Unfortunately, he died young. PCA is born in 1973. In 1983, the Presbyterian Church USA is formed by the merger of the two mainline denominations, the North and the South. If you recall, I have that chart for you. The confusing chart of the Presbyterian history, right? Then we have the 60s revolution, the rise of progressivism, globalism. That's not as obvious, but it is more obvious in hindsight. This comes about the 60s and 70s and 80s, and I'll talk a little more about it. And it becomes obvious to everybody by the 90s, I think, 90s and 2000s. Postmodernity overlaps with progressivism because postmodernity is mostly a philosophical approach to things, which progressives picked up, the modern liberals. As you know, the liberals or the Democrats today are not the ones you grew up with in the 60s and 70s, are they? It's changed. It's not the blue-collar party anymore, the party of the working class and the like. It has changed, and the flip came during the Obama administration when they wanted to make the Rainbow Coalition is what they called it. A coalition of all the minorities, both ethnic and sexual minorities, and anything else they can. And forget the whole working class. And all the working class went for Trump, is what we saw in 2015, 2016. Or a lot of them did. Francis Schaeffer, another big name. He's more known than Van Til. And maybe even probably E.J. Young, because E.J. Young would be a professor and seminaries would know him. But Francis Schaeffer was a very well-known popularizer. I remember him growing up as a kid. My parents had his book, What Shall We Believe, or something like that. I think I read through it a little bit. I may have watched a video of his. I don't recall from our church at the time. We had the rise of the moral majority. Who was there when that happened? All of us were there except for my daughter. That was under Reagan. Yeah. Yes, Mark. Correct. His reform was not always obvious. He wasn't like Sproul. You listen to Sproul, you're like, yeah, he's reformed. Francis Schaeffer, not so much. So that's why I said popular reformed. I suppose you can put reform in quote marks. I don't know him particularly theologically. But he was part of... denomination Tripp was in, reformed, they merged with the PCA. Can't remember the name of it. And they met on the seminary grounds in the mid-70s when we had a vote to merge with them, RCCUS or something. Francis Schaeffer changed his mind and said we shouldn't merge with the OPC. He argued on the floor. We argued to merge. That was one of the merging. We voted ourselves out of existence. They said, we don't want you. We did it again with the PCA, and the PCA said, we don't want you. And then the last time, we told the PCA, we don't want you, which is a good call. That's why I remember that. Because the conferences remember that. Geneva College or something on the campus that both General Assemblies were meeting at the time to vote on it. And the assumption was we're all going to merge. And Francis Schaeffer's like, no, we shouldn't do that. One of the claims, of course, is we're not... missionary-oriented enough or evangelical enough. That's very subjective anyways. What, because we only give 10% of our budget towards foreign missions? You guys give 50%, so we're not missionary enough, but we give, what, we would have more money for the poor or something? You know, it just depends on what you want to do with your funds. So, that's an old canard, in my opinion. The rise of the moral majority, this is relevant to our cultural status where we are, and that's also, I put that under church culture. You might want to put it under historical culture. I might change that, but it did affect the church culture. A lot of the cultural stuffs affect the church, and vice versa. Although less vice versa. The church has not had institutional power for a long time. That is some kind of influence. We speak, people aren't listening to us. We can't, move politicians to our advantage. We tried with the rise of the moral majority, and there was some effect there, but I don't think a lot of it was lasting. We certainly didn't get rid of abortion. Right? We had a majority, but we didn't get rid of abortion. Evangelicals and Reformed Together was a big push in 1994, and they wrote, they signed this document saying, we're united. We want to show that we love the Roman Catholic Church, and they're just like us. And they have some weird, superstitious things, but in these fundamental things, we have a lot of agreement. And someone famous like J.I. Packer, who's heard of J.I. Packer, signed the document that said, we have the same version of justification. And we do not have the same version of justification. J.I. Packer was fudging, as we like to say. Did not. We do not. We still do not. So that was a sad state. That was a valley. And unfortunately, it's been going downhill since then. You have the rise of theonomy and what we call radical or neo-two-kingdom theology. We talked a little bit about that. I'm not going to unpack a lot of that. There's really a lot that's been going on in the last 40, 50 years since I've been born, frankly. Theonomy is only noticeable, again, in conservative, probably Reformed circles, although it impacted conservative Baptist circles as well. And it's pretty much died out by now. Neo-two-kingdom is this kind of, we talk about two kingdoms, but we really are those who are moderates or libertarians in our social views, and so we kind of, as it were, after the fact, create this thing called Radical Two Kingdom, which justifies our social policies. And the easiest example of that, people may find it offended, I'm being recorded right now, but Professor Michael Horton at Westminster, who sits in the seat of Systematic Theology of Machen's chair, it is called, so he was not against, how did he put it, wouldn't have a problem with some kind of language like that, with civil unions. That was pre-2015. Yep. And his argument was an argument you're going to hear 100 years ago, and you hear it again today. Well, you know, the doctrine of love tells us to love our neighbor, and this is one way to show love to our neighbor. What? Try that with a pedophile, please. Oh, no, that you do have, you do draw a line, don't you? So that argument is really vague. It's like a wax nose, right? You can fill in the premises, the detailed premises any way you want with that general proposition. Right? So that's how you think. You make a general proposition, then you fill in a particular detail, and you draw a conclusion. All men are mortal. Phyllis is a man or mankind, a human, and she's mortal. Love your neighbor. Hitler's my neighbor. Therefore, give him money. What? That doesn't... That's why the premise is wrong. You have to adjust the major premise and even the minor premise. They're arguing wrong, and they're not narrowed down by God's specific law. It's very vague. So what happened with the Neo-2 kingdom is they reacted to Theonomus, basically, and went the other way. Although Theonomus also had a libertarian streak as well, interestingly enough. So, you have the fall of the wall, 1989. That's relevant to the rise of globalism. Anybody see why? Pardon? Trade, yes. Now there's no longer a big battle with the Eastern Bloc, with China, which is kind of involved to a minor extent, Russia, and all their other influences through Cuba and everything else. Now it's just trade, trade, trade. Look, the Eastern's open, Russia's open, China's now open under Clinton. We had the big China agreement, which flooded this nation with cheap labor, cheap products, and eventually, to some extent, cheap labor, because now it was even cheaper to outsource. Send the stuff to China, make it, then make it in America. They would send it through Mexico. That's why what Trump did was he shut down the Mexico route to force them to deal with us directly. So anyways, the implosion of the middle class has been occurring since my birth. And it's not obvious because, you know, when you get into the work field and things take a couple of years to finally catch up. There's always a lag or even a decade or so. But I've seen the numbers. They've showed the numbers for a very long time, since about 1971 or 73. I forget. I was born in 72. Income has not caught up with inflation. That's going to be an implosion. If you just keep, your income is like this and inflation is like that for 40 years, you're not going to catch up. And even the latest numbers show, I think I mentioned this in one of the sermons, there's so much of the middle class that's treading water with debt that we don't have a middle class like we thought we did. It's all an illusion. They can't pay off their house. They have the car debt. And part of that, of course, is they're spending, they were told, I should spend this much. This is what it means to be middle class. And they go into debt to spend that way. The other part is their income is not caught up. And we're seeing that now. Now we have inflation making it even worse. Noticeable inflation, but there's always been there. So I'm not going to go through the numbers. You can always ask me. I've been collecting all the data for the last 4 years. It's not good. Middle class is disappearing. And that's not good. And that's going to affect what? The churches. The social matters are relevant. The radical two kingdom kind of downplay that often and, again, tend to end up talking like a liberal or a moderate socially. And they'll tell you, guys, quit being so concerned about politics. Quit worshiping someone like Trump or a conservative politician. I'm not worshiping. I'm concerned about the implosion of the middle class because that affects the church. If you have a church full of poor people, you're not going to be able to do much. You probably barely pay the pastor. Makes it hard for outreach, et cetera, et cetera. So you need a middle class. And, of course, rich, but middle class is bigger than rich. You can't get a lot of rich people, but you get more middle class and you can't get rich. So you need the middle class for a backbone economically. God made the church to exist in society and economics, and we need these things. They are a concern. But it doesn't mean my hair is on fire either. Dr. Sproul, and I mentioned Pastor Joe. Who's Pastor Joe, you ask? I'm glad you asked. Pastor Joe is the average, everyday pastor, the everyman pastor. Not a big name, doesn't have a big church, doesn't have a lot of influence, but what influence he has is upon his church and perhaps people who respect him otherwise. This is what we have. We have no more Machens. We have no more Warfields. We have no more Hodges, both in theology and social issues. All the men I quote deal with social issues. The professors we have today typically don't, or they're very shy about it, in my opinion, or at least what I've read. And if they do, like in the case of Professor Horton, they blow it big time. They're not there. I'm sorry. And so what you have then is the everyday pastor is the one who has to stand in the gap, has to protect the church with a hole in the wall, flooding our families and our churches. Right? That's what I mean. Dr. Sproul was probably the last great one. He died in 2017. And unfortunately, even he couldn't keep up with the times because so much is changing so fast. So fast. The New Dark Ages, we are in the New Dark Ages and have been for a few decades, even if it doesn't feel that way, because again, it's like, you know, night and day. There's no night and day. You have dusk and dawn. You have this gray period. And that's where we are in right now. I'm going to tell you it's the Dark Ages. When you have, what was it, 52 or 56% of those between 16 and 65, according to the U.S. Labor and Statistics Department, whatever, have less than a sixth grade reading level, you're in the New Dark Ages. How can a church like ours help people like that when I preach at a 10th grade level at the least? And I would have a very hard time writing at a 7th grade level, let alone 6th or 5th. How can I instruct them? It takes hard work. It can be done, but it's not going to help the church grow, is it? Because by the time the church figured this out, and frankly have to dumb down their preaching and their writing, you're not going to grow. The people are going to be, you're already going to have a reputation. Imagine with me hanging out with Einstein. And you're not very humble. I mean, do you think the average American's humble? Raise your hand. You're not very humble, but you hang out with this guy named Einstein. Are you going to feel good or bad about it? You're going to feel like an idiot. And you're going to resent him. And that may explain why a lot of people don't take the church seriously, especially Reformed churches. Because, not because we're Einsteins, but because, I'm sorry, we don't preach or write at a fifth grade level. This isn't well known. I don't know people writing about this. Again, we don't have Hodges who knew the signs of the times. We have to know the signs of the times. And Pastor Joe is the one who has to figure it out now. Because he's not getting help, in my opinion, from the power that be in the churches. So we have the rise of progressives and moderates within the church. Celibate gay pastors, as you know, in the PCA. I'm not going to go down that route. I'm not going to talk much about it. You've all heard it before. And the rise of whites and Christian hate. They're almost synonymous now in the American scene. You have to be aware of that. Again, I've been keeping track of this. I can give you all the data in the news, even some statistical studies in which they ask people these things. So Pastor Joe is the everyman pastor, the unknown, the not-so-popular preacher taking care of the local church. I know a lot of them. Their influence is not broad, but their influence is real. They preach, they teach, they counsel as they are able. Then they try to protect the church from within and try to protect the church from without. Unfortunately, many of them are not well-trained or well-instructed, either theologically or practically. And of course, I don't mean in our denomination. I mean just all the conservative churches. I'm being very liberal, brothers and sisters. I'm not just saying Reformed, I'm saying Baptists and just conservative Baptists, even Arminians and the like. Frankly, a lot of them just simply aren't well-educated. Whether through their fault of their own or not, doesn't really matter. That's the state of the being where we are. However, many of them do know something is amiss and doesn't pass the smell test. That they do know. And so they try to push back. Something strange is being taught or practiced, even if they can't put their finger on it. Pastors such as Dr. Kappas often push back against new trends in the church. Unfortunately, as I point out, he and others don't get much support. There's a lot of silence by people who have a lot more influence in the Christian churches. We'll talk about some of those men a little bit later, who won't push back against those trends. And so because of this, a lot of pastors, a lot of laymen, a lot of ruling elders and people of influence in the churches have created ministries over the last few decades, created a podcast we're called today, which is just some guys talking, usually audible, like Apple has something. I can't remember the name of it. I don't pay for any of those services. Or on YouTube. We found one guy on YouTube who just talks about the issues going on in the churches and tries to push back against it, or at least inform and instruct you guys, hey, this is what's been going on. This is what these people, again, in the church, it isn't just all politics, but in the church, saying things like they're politicians on the left, mostly. This is not good. So, as I pointed out, it used to be the professors of the seminaries who were the front line of defense against the social pressures and political pressures and legal pressures and all the pressures upon the church. And unfortunately, that's not the case anymore. So what does he have to do? Pastor Joe, in addition to his regular preaching duties, he needs to be aware of the culture around him, the cultural trends. He needs to be aware of the politics and the policies and entertainment and social media trends. You're like, well, really? Doesn't he have a job? He does have a job. He's supposed to know the Word of God, but apply the Word of God to the people of God as the Word of God himself, as Christ applied it to his people, as Paul applied it to different circumstances in Corinth and different circumstances in Ephesus, for example. And in many ways, life was a lot simpler back then, but today it's a lot more complicated because we have a lot more things that can be done, keep us busy. So he needs to be aware of these things because those trends affect the church. Who's heard of TikTok? Oh, really? Okay, good. It's been getting around. Yet another social media. I'm not even anywhere near on it. And I guess you do 2 or 3 minute clips of videos, and it's usually silly things, but a lot of sexual stuff. You're probably not aware of that. The media doesn't tell you that. And now transgender. They've had billions of views of people trying to tell you, I could become a boy, I could become a girl. On TikTok, and it influences people. The pastor doesn't know this, and he puts his kid on TikTok. Doesn't tell his church. Now, he can't always know these things. You can't blame him. There's so much stuff to know, isn't there? It's incredible. Somebody's got to be on top of it. And unfortunately, it's on the shoulders of the people who are already busy. Our professors are trained not to be your pastors, but to be on top of things, in my opinion. But they're not. At least not enough of them are. To understand our times, we have to understand the times of our nations because it affects our nations. Because these things, the TikTok, the podcasts, right, the parachurch ministries are conduits into the church, aren't they? I mean, people listen to big names within the church, even in conservative circles. You have to be aware of these things. The rise of progressive globalism, lack of a better name, the social, political, and legal rise of progressivism is important. Why? Because it is a source of constant, unrelenting pressure upon the church, and especially her leadership. We saw that last year. Don't get confused and think, well, it's just BLM. It wasn't just BLM. BLM is just but one manifestation of a larger trend in our society. Progressivism is a political and social teaching of what? Be curious what you guys think progressivism is. This is relevant to the church. I'm not just preaching politics. You're all shy. That's fine. Yeah, if I asked you, what is progressivism, what would you say? Sure. But so is communism, but you wouldn't call it communism, would you? Progressivism is not communism. It could be, but it's not the same thing as. I mean, if you call someone a communist and not a communist, you're not going to win the debate. Call someone a capitalist, and he's not a capitalist, but he's on his way to become a capitalist. You're not really debating the same guy. Just flip it, right? There's no difference. Bruce.
I think it's just another name, and they try to nuance it so that it doesn't sound principles
or marks. Okay. I think there's some truth in that because in one sense it's a complicated movement with lots of moving parts and different positions and subcategories like the Roman Catholic Church. We see this now with Hillary Clinton pushing back against the radical element in her circles. The way I define progressivism is more broad. It is a political and social teaching that all of our problems would go away if all of our differences went away. But that's one manifestation of it, sure. Humanism actually has a historical significant definition to it, which doesn't necessarily include this. The old school humanist, i.e. atheist, didn't disagree with all differences. You see. But you could argue their position was rooted in that. It's like the conservatives, right? We all have the old joke about going off the cliff at 80 miles an hour and the conservatives going off the cliff at 40 miles an hour. But if they're both going off the cliff, they just lag by 10 years, for example. And so the humanists, I would argue, just lagged. They weren't consistent with their basic premise, which is egalitarianism, to destroy all differences. And I think when you see that lens, it makes a lot more sense. Yes, Bruce.
The difference between a conservative and a progressive going off the cliff is the conservative is going to have his foot on the brake and the progressive is
going to
have his foot on the gas.
Sure. They're still going off. They're both going off the cliff, yeah. So my point is, the broader idea of egalitarianism may have different manifestations economically. The traditional communist Marxist approach saw the whole world through the lens of economics, the oppressed and the oppressees, and the haves and the have-nots, economically, not necessarily socially, not necessarily politically. Those things did exist, but they came downstream from the basic source of economics. That was their focus. That's why you can't technically call a lot of the progressives communists today. The old communists wouldn't recognize them. But they still had the overlap of what? We should all be equal economically. We should destroy all distinctions economically. Which, of course, will have the impact of destroying all distinctions socially, because they do interact with one another. I'm not denying that. But I'm saying there's more to life than just economics. It's not the only way. You shouldn't focus and reduce everything that way. And so the progressives today, although some of them may be actual traditional old-school communists, others are variations of it, others are not even related to that at all. They could be, you could be a progressive capitalist. You can be progressive capitalists. We see it right now. They're called big business. We saw what big business has been doing with BLM and everything else. You talk about go woke, go broke. They haven't been going broke. Because it's not about the money. They actually believe this stuff. A lot of them do. Not all of them. It's more, I mean, it's just, you know, this guy's an exception. That, of course, but there's a more than you realize. They're not going broke, brothers and sisters. They actually believe this stuff. So they're radical, part of progressivism, destroying. That's why I put the eschatological angle in there, right? The teaching that all our problems would go away, i.e. heaven on earth, if all our differences went away. At least if we tolerate differences. That's how it started out first, isn't it? We should just tolerate the differences. This used to be said out loud when I was a kid. Sure it was when you were a kid. Now they're going beyond that. Forget the tolerance. You will submit, right? Anybody remember the 1980s song, We Are the World? Not to be confused with We Are the Worms. That's the version I liked when I was a kid. Out on the sidewalk, we make a squishy sound when you step on us. Okay. We Are the World. They got all these big singing stars together to sing a sad song about starving people in Africa or something. We can't go on pretending day by day that someone somewhere soon make a change. We're all a part of God's great big family, and the truth, you know, love is all we need. Because what? Love would destroy all distinctions and create tolerance. Isn't that the implication? That's what they believe now. At the time, maybe you missed it, but now you're like, oh yeah, that's what they're really singing about. To them, love, again, is like a wax nose. It's a vague concept that they can shove all the wicked sin in there and say, look, don't make moral distinctions. I mean, as much as you hear them say, well, don't make ethnic distinctions, don't make economic distinctions, the capitalists or the communists, what it really comes down to is don't make moral distinctions. Right? Egalitarianism, morally speaking. Pardon? Oh, I have not watched that movie. The Time Machine, H.G. Wells. I remember the name of the, I don't remember the specifics there. I'll take your word for it. Mark predates me. Love is all we need, right? For what? The implication, of course, in the song is to fix the problems of the world. Starvation, if it said more love, it would just fix everything. And what kind of love, of course? We know now, and some of us knew then, it was just the law, the love of, supposed love of tolerance, forbearance, and ultimately of license, right? Of course, this is not true love, but liberty to sin. That's what they were singing about. The other way to look at it is through the earlier song, John Lennon. He, too, sang of progressivism. See, that's why I put that there about the 60s. It became more obvious now. The 60s was a rebellion against the supposed conservatism. It wasn't as conservative as we think it is, if you look in retrospect, and legally. But that's what they saw it as, and that's what they pushed against it. And the 60s are calling the shots now. They grew up, the boomer class, most of them wicked, and now they're leading us in both parties. Imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do, nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Right? Destroy all distinctions. level the playing field of any domain, especially the moral domain. But wait, the moral domain affects everything, doesn't it? Are nation states morally right or morally wrong? That's a moral question, isn't it? So even behind this, you see, don't look at them just saying get rid of countries. Behind it is get rid of moral distinctions and let me do what I want to do, which is what Satan's lie is, isn't it? That's why I say the broader concept is forget the political trends, forget the social trends in terms of finding out what's at base and behind it all. What's behind it all is to excuse sin and to use the mechanism of egalitarianism of leveling the field, destroying all distinctions. Everyone see that? You may not agree with me, but I'm very convinced of this. You look at it and go, oh, that, okay, yeah, all the pieces are coming together now. The song is more explicit, of course, than We Are the World. Lenin's song is a song of globalism. If we only got rid of those pesky nation states, everything would go well. Globalism is part and parcel of progressivism. That's why I call it progressive globalism. For the capitalists and the big business of America, progressivism and globalism are the tools to open world markets. Tear down those tariffs, get rid of the borders, let us flood your nation with our goods so we can make more money. And in fact, get rid of families, because families spend less money than singles on my products. Everyone see that now? Been a very big push, big business to get rid of families. And of course, the homosexual agenda doesn't support families. It's two single guys and two single women with two different incomes where the families struggle. So, it's not just communism. It's the capitalists too. And it's important because in the church, if we just keep thinking it's communism and forget the capitalists, it's going to affect us as well. They're not our friends. They're not here to help you. They're here to take your money and let you rot and die, in my opinion. And the church is not aware of that. The church will fall for it and get suckered into politics and everything else. It's going to affect the churches. And I haven't gotten to that, and apparently I'm not going to get to that. We have about 2 minutes left, and I'll give you the good stuff. I want to call it the good stuff next week. Any questions so far? I'm only covering this because it's current. It's part of history. Your children and grandchildren will know about this time and day and age. And this is my analysis of it. You may not fully agree with it. You may not agree with it at all. But these are the trends I've been watching in the church. Anything else? Okay, let's pray. We do come before you, God, thanking you for your word, knowing that Jesus shall return and that you are in charge right now, even though it may look bleak in society and in our churches, God. May we lift our eyes upon you and upon your victory and upon your strength and power and your love for us, Lord. May we find comfort therein. In the name of the Lord we pray. Amen.